Noble Dairy Queen's new summer blizzard menu is back, and it is stacked. Dive right into the summer celebration with their new peanut butter cookie dough party blizzard. You can sink your red spoon into their world-famous DQ soft serve, filled with delicious chunks of chocolate chip cookie dough, swirls of creamy peanut butter topping, and peanut brittle crunch with sprinkles. If the peanut buttery flavor isn't your jam, their fresh take on cobbler a la mode certainly will. Say hello to the Picnic Peach Cobbler Blizzard. You can also let your taste buds crumble with the Ultimate Cookie Blizzard that features Oreo, Chips Ahoy, and Nutter Butter pieces. Dairy Queen knows everyone loves a good comeback, and fan favorite Blizzard flavors Frosted Animal Cookie, Brownie Batter, and Cotton Candy have made their triumphant return. Summer Blizzard flavors are now available at your Noble Dairy Queen stores with locations in Kankakee, Bourbonnais, Moments, and Manteno. Happy tastes good.
People tend to stick to
hello and welcome to Kankakee Podcast, where we talk about the people and places of Kankakee County. I'm Jake Lamour, and we are on location once again, and this time at the Kankakee County Museum. This is actually our third time we've ever recorded an episode here, but this is the first time that we've had Jack and Jory join us actually at the museum, so this is exciting. And particularly, if you've ever been to the museum, you know it's very sizable. There's a lot of different rooms you can be in, and each room is very unique. And the room we are currently sitting in is actually the room we are, the room exhibit that we're going to be talking about on this episode. But first, I want to welcome Jack Clacy and Jory Walters, of course. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Oh,
thank you. We're always happy to have you come to the museum.
Happy to be here, too. And, you know, we're recording this not too far before Jory's birthday. So I want to say happy birthday. I actually
thank
have
you.
A card. I have a card for you. Don't let
you.
Me forget. I got to bring
She's
that
29.
To you. 29, looking
thank
fine,
you.
As they say. So, yeah, I have a card. Don't let me forget. I need to give that to you. But, yeah,
thank
happy
you.
Happy early birthday. So we are talking about George Gray Barnard today. And that is the exhibit we're currently in now. And it's the museum's probably biggest exhibit or one of the biggest exhibits. I would say this is one of the most prominent.
This is either the largest or second largest exhibit space. I don't remember exactly, but this is also the newest of the exhibit spaces. It was opened in 1991, a major expansion of the museum. The other large gallery dates back to 1972, and that's our Kankakee History Gallery, the big gallery on the south end of the building. But either that or this are about the same square footage. This one may be a little bit better. And, of course, much taller.
Yes, the ceiling.
And beautifully lighted, which doesn't matter too much with the statues. We don't have an awful lot of lighting in the other galleries because there's deterioration of paper goods and some of the exhibits.
When you walk into the Barnard exhibit, I know one of my the very first time I walked in here, the thing that crossed my mind was, okay, what in the world does this have to do with Kankakee County, right? And I feel like that's most people's reaction because there are, while Barnard was very famous, there's still a lot of people that have no idea who he is and that he actually was born here, correct? He was not born. There is a significance, though. There is a connection. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize.
He was born in Pennsylvania. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and he actually was more like a traveling minister. So he went from different places that they lived, and one place that they settled in for a time was Kankakee. And he was a boy. George Gray Barnard was a boy when he lived here. And his father, people know the first Presbyterian church on Court Street, the big red brick building. I think that was the second building, but that church, his father was a minister there.
From 1870 until 1877.
And so the connection to that church and family. So he grew up here. His boyhood friends were Frank McGrew, who had the mill on River Street, and Harry Troop, I think it was Troop Lumber eventually.
Roger Sherman, whose father was a businessman.
Was the mill, was that a lumber mill? That
No, it was a paper mill? Flour mill, I believe.
Yeah, McGrew's mill was the one was down by the dam on the on River Street.
Okay.
We have a lot of pictures of that in paintings, et cetera. So some famous people that were significant, who grew up to be significant leaders in our area. And so George Gray Barnard lived here for a time.
This is a picture of young George Gray Barnard when he came here, probably at about age 8 or 9. He came here when he was 7 years old, when he came here in 1870. And of course, when family moved away in 1877, he was about 14 years old. But he looks artistic already, even in that young age.
But he didn't have any artistic upbringing. I mean, he didn't have much association with art until he went to Paris.
Okay, so when he lived here as a young boy, he wasn't doing that we know of. He wasn't doing anything artistic necessarily in his time here.
Now, there is one thing.
Oh, yes. Sort of.
This is a piece of barn board. And I don't know whether the resolution is fixed just to see it, but the initials GB and the date 77 on that. This was from a barn at the home of Roger Sherman, who was one of his close childhood friends. And that barn was located at Indiana and Oak Street, where currently it's the police department right now, but it was originally the city hall. And when that city hall was built in the 1920s, the barn was torn down, and Roger Sherman salvaged that piece of carving with George Gray Barnard's initials and sent it on to him in New York. And we actually do have that piece of barn board here in the exhibit.
It made its way back here?
Made its way back
here. Oh, wow. That's
it was
so
probably
cool.
The first example we have of George actually carving something.
I mean,
well, he probably made, clay models or something.
Yeah. I just think it's funny, like, we have just him being a boy and just carving his name into things, because, like, we all did that as kids, right? Especially if you see, like, freshly poured cement, you're like, I'm going to put an initial in that, or I'm going to, I'm going to
put even your handprint.
Your handprint or whatever, So.
George was a student at Jory's favorite building, I think, in Kankakee, favorite school building, Central School.
Yes. It was one of my favorite pictures in our collection and a piece of architecture in our community that I absolutely love.
So Central School, that's where I'm gonna do a shot in the dark and see if I remember this, but I'm probably gonna get it wrong. Central School was located where one of the county jail buildings is
close.
I'm close.
Walk
okay.
Away. It actually was on the southeast corner of Indiana and and Merchant Street. Across the street from the courthouse, south of the courthouse. It's now an open field between there and the jail, which is at Station Street.
Okay.
Where the jail is was where the high school was, departmental school.
Okay. So I knew there was a school there. I just got the wrong one.
Yeah, Central School was interesting. It was just opened in 1869. It was built in 1869. And so George Barnard would have been among the first students in that building.
Wow.
And he and his friends, and especially George himself, formed a very strong attachment to that building. For some reason, he always referred to it as my beloved Central School, or our beloved Central School, if he was writing a letter. He kept up, through a good portion of his life, he kept up correspondence with some of his friends that he grew up with here in Kankakee.
I think school spirit was just a lot different back then. Oh, yeah. You know, it's just, it's not like it is today. Not to say that no one has school spirit, but. Yeah.
Well, we'll be coming back to George Gray Barnard and his relationship with the Central School later on. But of course, his father was transferred or went to, and I'm not sure, it may have been Muscatine, Iowa. I think that may have been the next stop on his journey. And I'm not sure the dates exactly. And at a later date, the Barnard family relocated to Madison, Indiana, down at the southern end of the state. But that was, by that time, George was growing and gone from home. When he was in his late teens, about 19, he was attended the Art Institute of Chicago for a time. I don't know how long, probably a matter of a year or two or less. But he had done a marble bust called Young Girl, which won some kind of prize, and we don't have anything on the amount and so forth, but it was apparently substantial enough that it allowed him to go to France and study at the with sculptors in Paris.
L'École Nationale des Beaux-Arts Paris.
Oh, yeah. The Beaux-Arts, which is, of course, the premier school for architects and artists in Paris. And he studied there. Well, he lived and worked in France for about 12 years total. He was at studied sculpture for 4 years, from 1883 to 1887. But then he worked in France as a sculptor, and actually managed to make a living, apparently, because he stayed there for 8 years, and he didn't have a fortune. Obviously, he had whatever he managed to earn up. But during that time, I believe it was 1894, there was a major art exhibit on the Champ de Mars near the Eiffel Tower, which was very high-level art show. And he had, I believe, six pieces in that show and was greatly lauded for the quality of his sculpture, and he became quite well known at the time. I believe some of his material was quite reminiscent of Rodin.
Okay.
One of the works that drew a lot of praise at that show was one called The Struggle of Two Natures in Man, which had been commissioned by a man named Alfred Corning Clark, who was the heir to the Singer sewing machine fortune. So he had some money to throw around.
Gosh. So is that piece here?
The plaster study of it is here, yes.
Okay.
And this was a huge work. George Gray Barnard, as anybody will see who comes into this exhibit, he liked to work big.
Yes.
Many of his statues were 8 to 10 feet tall, or some were even larger. But his study of Struggle of Two Natures in Man had been commissioned by Alfred Corning Clark, who became kind of his patron. He supported him for a portion of his needs and so forth. And the study of Two Natures in Man is two male nudes, one lying down and one standing over, and very dynamic looking. Did I hold this up to show or not?
Yeah.
Because I hadn't yet. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that is a little miss. There's nothing for scale there, but this is those two figures. The tallest figure there is probably 8 feet in height.
So that's massive.
Get an idea of how large his approach and how many large his works are.
So that was kind of the piece that really put him in the view of people, right? That's when people started
being acknowledged as a really great sculptor and so forth. That particular, the original, the marble of that of that work is currently in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
Oh, wow.
It was given to the Metro by the Clark heirs when they died. Anything further in this area, Jerry?
Well, he stayed in Paris for a while, but then he decided to come back to America against the advice of some prominent people. But he did he did learn a lot in Paris, but he had to, since he didn't have in the school as much art education prior to that, he kind of had to take some classes, and then he really was kind of up to grade with art with the rest of the students. But he really kind of accelerated in what he did. And then eventually he wanted to move back to America. And then we will pick it up from there.
So when he came back to America, I'm assuming it was the East Coast?
Yes, when he came back, he resettled in New York City in 1896. And for 3 years, he taught at the Art Students League in New York, which is a very famous art school there. He succeeded a man named Augustus St. Gaudens, who, of course, was the most prominent American sculptor at the time. Barnard sculptures, overall, of course, as I mentioned, they tend to be very monumental, very huge, colossal type score. And in 1911, he completed, I believe it was, not, yeah, 1911, he completed two huge groups of marble sculptures of 27 individual human figures for the entrance of the Pennsylvania State Capitol building. Now, the work that he did on that, he went back to France because he had a whole group of assistants available there to do all the work of doing this. And for several years, for I think 6 to 7 years, they were doing the sculptural work there, and then everything was shipped back over to the Pennsylvania for installation at the courthouse.
Are those still there?
They are still there, yes. And they're really amazing. And there's one group on each side of the main entrance.
Oh,
and that has,
wait a minute.
Here I think go. The jury has a picture here somewhere.
Celebrate Mother's Day with D. Westfall Jewelers on Broadway and Bradley. You can shop 20% off store-wide from now until Mother's Day. If you spend $199 or more now through May 8th, you can receive a $25 gift card from Texas Roadhouse. And then, from May 9th through the 12th, if you spend $199 or more, receive a bouquet of flowers from Bada Bloom in Bourbonnais. Mom deserves to shine this Mother's Day with new jewelry from D. Westfall Jewelers on Broadway and Bradley. Like and follow D. Westfall Jewelers on Facebook and Instagram for more info.
So, yeah, they're right on the outside, as you had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So did the state of Pennsylvania commission him to do those, or how did that work?
Yes, it was a contract. It's pretty controversial because the building of the new state capitol building turned out to be a swamp of graft and misappropriation of funds and all kinds of things. And unfortunately, Barnard was kind of caught in the middle on this. Originally, he was dealing with the architect who had designed the Capitol, and he was supposed to get $700,000 for developing these two groups of sculptures. Well, fairly shortly after that, the architect came back and says, oh, we can't afford all that much. I think we need to cut back to maybe $200,000. And George Barnard said, well, I'm not happy about this, but this is my native state. This is where I was born. So, yeah, let's go ahead. Well, then later, and this was all in a period maybe about a year or so. He was working away at them already. The architect came back and he said, boy, we just run into real problems here. He said, the best I can do, I think, is $100,000, but with a performance clause or something, if you have them in the right time, we add another $200,000 possibly to that. So he signed a contract for it. Barnard himself had to put out $20,000 for a bond that he would finish them up.
Oh my God.
I don't know whether he ever actually got any money out of this at all.
Probably
there was
not.
A major investigation in the early 1900s or 19-teens over the corruption and problems with building the building. And I don't know whether possibly they got some money for him or not. I've never found any evidence that they had.
Yeah.
Man. But
so after he does that, where does he go from there?
Then he went on to one of his favorite projects of all time. he was a great fan of Abraham Lincoln.
And what was that from, like, just his family?
Well, I read, now, I heard something different. So I believe I read, and if I am wrong, I will come back on our next podcast and correct it. But I believe that I read in my notes from the box that his wife, when she was a baby, Abraham Lincoln held her. And I guess first person to hold her, something to that effect. But then one of my coworkers said, well, wait a minute. We have over on the wall here that says that he was the one that Abraham Lincoln held. So I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
Wow.
I think I just want to make sure that I read it right. So it's one or it's the other, but that's how he became interested in Abraham Lincoln.
So that might be why, I don't know if I'm spoiling anything, but is that where his obsession with his hands comes into play then?
He didn't really have an obsession with his
well,
hands.
Maybe
well,
maybe not obsession.
The hands play into a very important part of the story later on.
Right. But I just wonder if you know, either himself or his wife was once held as a baby by Lincoln, if that's why
Lincoln's
hands.
Yep. That very well could be. But that's the underlying story. And actually, I will come back on the next podcast and verify for sure.
Okay.
However, I believe, too, that he also, though, Lincoln was and always has been kind of a heroic figure to most Americans because of Honest Abe and all these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that Barnard thought of him as sort of a hero to him also as an American.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did quite a large number of studies of Lincoln, whether they're heads or full body, full height studies or details like the hands and so forth. In 1917, well, actually a couple of years before that, he got a commission from the Taft family of Ohio, former presidential family, to create a very large statue of Abraham Lincoln that would be placed in a park in Cincinnati, Ohio. In 1917, he completed the statue, which is huge. It's approximately 12, 13 feet tall.
Oh,
and here's
yeah.
an example wow. showing with a couple of human beings to show the scale, how large that, and that's a bronze statue. And you'll notice something if you look closely at that, and I'm not sure the resolution is enough. Lincoln has no beard.
Oh yeah, so he's a younger.
He's a younger
Lincoln, right?
Right. All of the that I can remember, all of the statues of Lincoln and studies of Lincoln that Barnard did, he was beardless. It was a younger Lincoln, and he also showed Lincoln kind of not in a heroic type mood. It was really more a oh, here's Abe who lives next door, sort of as a real human being. And that didn't go over very well with a lot of the, even with the Tafts, and for that matter, Lincoln's own son. They thought that the depiction of Lincoln was disrespectful. It
wow.
didn't show him heroic enough.
Wasn't up on the pedestal, right?
Yes. Yeah, the statue depicted Lincoln with rough-hewn features and kind of a slouching posture. He was not, you know, the great heroic figure that he was not riding on a horse, for example, like a general or something of that mm-hmm. sort. So that statue still exists in Lytle Park in Cincinnati, Ohio. And there actually are two more copies of it. And these are bronze statues. One is in Manchester, England. And the other is in Louisville, Kentucky.
Hmm.
And of course, if anybody visiting the gallery here will find many other depictions of Lincoln.
There's a lot of Lincoln stuff in here.
Some full size, but a lot more in detail or in head and shoulders or bust studies. We have two very large heads, probably 3.5, 4 feet tall. in the entry to the gallery, one of which is a plaster that has been painted to resemble bronze, but the other is a marble study of Lincoln, and that's on permanent loan to us from the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. We also, as I say, have other smaller studies of one kind or another. In later life, after he was done with the Lincoln statues and so forth, he had after World War I, he had a major project that he spent the rest of his life working on. He wanted to create a giant, what he called a peace arch, or sometimes a rainbow arch. And it was going to be like 100 feet long and who knows how tall, probably 30, 40 feet high. And by that time, he was living up in the northern end of... Oh, there. Jory has a picture, at a concept anyway.
I don't think I've ever seen that before.
His studios were at the northern end of Manhattan Island, up at which kind of a remote area at that time because everything was down south. But he wanted to have this peace arch erected on the northern tip of Manhattan to honor those who died in World War I, and to promote the idea that peace is preferable to war, et cetera. Mm-hmm. A 100-foot-long project had more than 50 huge allegorical statues. And I'm looking at one right here. It's another over there.
Okay.
One right here. Those have come to us eventually. He worked on the project and never completed it. By the time he died in 1938, it was only partially completed, and it stood for a while. But after a year or two, his son Monroe decided, I don't know if they had pressure from the courts because of something to do with the will or whatever, but he dismantled this and stored away all of the statues for a while. Eventually, as I mentioned, some of them turned up here, and we'll deal with that in a while. The Peace Arch statues are some of the more strange pieces that he has. They depict various kinds of emotions and so forth, and they're just they're very different, even from his earlier work. I think as he matured and as he became an older artist, he had different ideas.
Liked, when he was in the French countryside, he also collected Gothic.
Yes.
Remains.
Architectural bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm. So I gathered 48 columns and 50 arches, and he did the cloisters in New York City, and it's a museum of Gothic architecture. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of it. And so he had that interest as well.
Yes, that in fact, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Of Gothic
and medieval art
and so he had which is very different from what we
yeah
have
I was gonna
here.
Say this yes. I don't think medieval when I see this stuff. It's more like Renaissance of feeling.
So that was another aspect of his work. Mm-hmm. And things that he did in his interests.
Okay.
Yeah, actually he survived and fed his family for a number of years. Well, I think this was during the big mess over the Pennsylvania State Courthouse or Pennsylvania State Capitol. He supported himself and his family by serving as an art dealer or architectural. He would go out and find architectural remnants and so forth that had been in France, out in the countryside and small towns and so forth, and sold those to individual collectors or to museums and so forth, and managed to support his family. He also, though, retained a good portion of the material for himself because he was an admirer of the medieval art and the Gothic, and apparently, you know, the entire countryside in France at that time was more or less littered with half-buried materials that he could work. But he brought them back to the country, and the cloisters, which was next door to his studio on the northern tip of Manhattan, was a huge development. It was a very, it took the form of a monastery. Mm-hmm. And then had, and what happened was the, I'm not sure, it was after his death, I believe, that the Rockefellers purchased the cloisters. Mm-hmm. And later made that, turned that over to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it became a, and it's still a very popular tourist destination in Manhattan.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I was in Manhattan a number of years ago, and I wanted to get up there, and I just wasn't able to make it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But
Barnard called his creation the monastery and installed a gatekeeper dressed as a monk to greet visitor.
Yes. Yeah, 1925. Oh, I'm sorry. It was before before Barnard's death. In 1925, Rockefeller purchased the cloisters.
So just things that I'm thinking about as we've been talking, been listening to you, both of you talk about Barnard. One of the things that comes to my mind is, how did he get commissioned for some of these things by such high people in, you know, was it, I'm just curious at how that process worked, if you have any indication. I know, you know, that very first one that kind of put him in the
view Carney of the, Clark.
Yeah, that kind of put him in the view of the public. Was that just the gateway in, or, you know, how would you go about getting these commissions?
The biggest part of it, I think, is probably reputation. Once he had formed the relationship with Alfred Corning Clark, who I think was an expatriate American living in Paris at the time, Clark was well known in various circles as an art patron, and also, you know, was one of the upper level people. And I think that's a small organization. Words gets around. And also, though, I think because Barnard was developing a very, very good reputation as a sculptor, other wealthy people decided that they would commission him to do something. For example, it might be a one. I'm trying to think of the, I can't think of the individual piece, but the Rockefellers commissioned him to do a piece, a rather large piece, for their estate up on the Hudson in New York.
Okay.
And after the St. Louis, or at the St. Louis World's Fair of 1904, he exhibited a piece that he had been commissioned to do called The Hewer, which we have the original plaster copy of here. And it's a man kind of crouched over, hewing away the wood at some point, carving something. And that, after the Columbian, after the St. Louis 1904 World's Fair, the family that had commissioned that was from Cairo, Illinois. And they had the statue moved from St. Louis back to Cairo, and it's still there. It's along one of the streets in the middle of town. Several years ago, one of our board members here, or in fact, our board president at the time, suggested we might want to try to negotiate with the people in Cairo, Illinois, to let us pick up the Hewer and bring it up here, because Cairo apparently is a city that has a very bad budget problem and so forth. So we thought maybe we might be able to do so. I don't think it ever reached the point where we contacted them, but we were just speculating on the idea that would be a fantastic addition to our museum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is a piece that people, just like an everyday person, might realize that they've seen it and they didn't know it was Barnard? Is there anything that sticks
probably
out?
Probably one of the Lincoln statues.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's any others that are, they might have, you know, if they are going to art galleries such as the Museum of Modern Art in New York, they would probably have seen that. There are, Barnard works in a number of other galleries, but not a huge number of them. A lot are in private collections.
Yeah.
The question that came up, of course, is how did they get here?
Right. That's one thing is, how in the world did all of these are all plaster for the most part.
We have a few pieces which are not, but there's, for example, a wooden clock stand over here that's like 9 feet high.
Yeah. So my guess is that this has something to do with how well he kept in contact with some of his classmates from Central School.
He did,
is that what
yes.
is? Okay.
We have letters,
yes,
collection from his boyhood friends. And he really wanted to have a Barnard Museum to house his works. And
in Central School.
In Central
oh,
School.
Oh, okay.
Because he felt, because he was not exposed as a student to much art, if any, in school, that he really wanted the students to be able to see works of art, his art. But there's a little bit of controversy about that. Go for it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say,
what's the controversy?
We'll touch on the controversy in a little while, but I want to also touch on what Jory was saying about how he wanted the students to understand that, you know, they were going to be exposed to art.
Yeah.
There's a letter that he wrote at the time that it was in 1936 or thereabout, that he wrote to the students at Central School after the statues had been delivered here. And he wrote, "When I was seated where my statues are now, I had nothing to study or see of beauty in art. No painting, no sculpture. I never saw a true statue in marble until at 20 I arrived in Paris. Of all my honors, the greatest is your placing our work in our beloved school."
Children are naturally drawn to art and the creative process. For them, it can be a form of expression as they explore the materials, gain confidence, and feel a sense of competency as they create something based on their own ideas and efforts. That's why Little Me's studio in Bourbonnais created the Big Kids Art Lab for ages 5 to 12. Little Me's studio crafted this safe space for your big kid to slow down, be in the moment, and be comfortable making messes while trying something new. Big Kids Art Lab meets every Thursday from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. at Little Me's studio across the street from Olivet Nazarene University in Bourbonnais. Studies indicate that art making has so many positive effects for the brain, body, mind, and heart. Enroll in one class at littlemestudio.com or sign up for the entire session and save. littlemestudio.com to sign up for Big Kids Art Lab. Make sure you follow Little Me Studio on Facebook and Instagram.
So did they actually get placed in the school?
Yes, they did.
Okay, they did. I thought maybe you were going to tell me they didn't.
The first statues that were brought here, which he had offered, those that he offered to the school board in Kankakee, were in Madison, Indiana, where his parents had lived for 30 years. And I think, you know, he had a lot of his materials stored away there. There were probably close to 100 pieces in Madison.
Oh, wow.
And they had been on display in, I think, a local church there or an empty building of some sort for about 6 or 7 years. But Barnard felt, and I had probably with good cause, that they weren't really valued there. They were, you know, oh, okay, there's that sculptor's stuff.
Yeah, the father, you know, his son was a sculptor. These are his, right. You know, these yeah, are his sculptures, and that's all there is to it, right? There's not right. much.
So what he did was then, you know, basically tell Madison, okay, I'm going to give these away to Kankakee. You know? So he sent a letter to Kankakee School Board asking if they would like to have these statues. And the board took it under advisement fairly briefly and said, yeah, we think we would. And we, you know, we could find room. We'll find a room in Central School for this.
And this is later on in his life. This so I'd imagine.
Yeah, 1936.
Yeah, so that's, and what, 2 years before,
2 years before he died.
Yeah, so at this point, I would imagine he's fairly well-known in his...
Quite well-known, and also in his upper 80s, so he was, you know, running down. Yeah. He was not in good health those last couple of years. But the school board sent a delegation down to Madison to look at the statues, and they came back saying, oh, yeah, definitely. So they made arrangements to have them created up, and about 40 of them, I think, that were they chose, they couldn't handle all of them, brought them here. And they were installed, or stored at least, in a vacant room at Central School. There was, as Jory intimated, one little problem. Through the years, because, and between handling and just, you know, the environmental things, they were in need of cleaning, and some parts were in need of repair and so forth. So the board was discussing this and what kind of arrangements they could make to get the store, the, you know, work done, and have the repair work done and cleaning necessarily. And something unfortunately came up. Jory, you remember?
Well, I'm going to read a little bit here. Months of cleaning and repair work, but the school district ran out of money for the repairs and the work was never completed. But another quote, of course, placed the usual fig leaf on the male statues. My mother will be free just as your school vacation begins. He can clean and repair all of them. Well, although the pants story had been denied, some unknown board managed to write a bit more mileage from the when the district ran out of funds. Okay, quote, in misery is Kankakee, its mood is far from sunny, or pants it broods for 50 nudes and hasn't got the money.
That was one of the best piece of poetry I think I've ever run across.
Wow. I was going to say, that's pretty good. That's some good, fine Kankakee poetry right there. It doesn't get much better than that. So, things really haven't changed that much.
I have the feeling that I know who the poet was.
Barnard wasn't angry about some of them people wanting to cover a little.
Was one of the Smalls one of the poets? Is that what you were going to say?
No, the person that I believe, and I've never pinned this down, but there was a, when I worked for the Journal in 1963, the general manager was a former reporter who had been kind of the really good reporter through the years and so forth. And I believe that he was at covering the schools at that time. And if anybody was a candidate for writing that, I think he was. I will not mention his name because people would know it.
Yeah. Okay.
But I always had the feeling that, yeah, that's the guy who wrote that poem.
So I'm guessing Kankakee School District runs out of money. They put these things in storage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they actually did, when they did display them for a while.
Right.
After a fair number of them.
Yeah, because they took, 40 pieces, you said?
There were about 45 pieces, I think, that had come from Madison, Indiana. Unfortunately, Kankakee kept growing, and the need for classroom space caused them to say, we can't afford to take one of the classrooms in this building as a museum anymore. We'll have to put them in storage somewhere. Mm-hmm. So they, I believe, tucked them away somewhere down in the basement of the courthouse.
Okay. I was wondering if that's when the courthouse comes into play.
Yes.
So much stuff got stored in the courthouse.
And what with, you know, less than wonderful climatic conditions and so forth, I'm sure they could, and probably some rough handling. Mm-hmm. They didn't work very well over the years.
So are any of those pieces here?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
In the Barnard pieces found a home in 1948 when this building, well, not this, our original building of our museum, the Historical and Arts Building, was opened in October of 1948. A number of the pieces were taken out of storage and displayed, especially in, there's one room which originally was the art room. It has a very large north-facing window. It's now one of our galleries. But I think a number of the statues were displayed there, and also is the meeting headquarters for the Kankakee Art League. Mm-hmm. And so finally, at least some of the Barnard material was on proper display. Mm-hmm. And gradually, some of this was stored away. Through the years, more and more of those were displayed. There was a rumor at one time that Fanny Still, who was the original curator of the museum, and a wonderful lady, but in her probably 80s at the time, used to do student tours. And there were rumors, and I never were able to pin them down, but that she somehow managed to cover up the offending parts of some of the some of the nudes when the student groups were coming through. Again, I can't authenticate that.
Well, and that's been the blunt of the joke, since they've been here, right? Is bring students in here and they see not all the sculptures are nude, but a lot of them are.
Many of them are, yes.
Well, every time we get a student, most every time we get a student group and we meet the kids coming through the door there, and I'll say hi to them and everything, they're like, "Can we go see the naked?" No, that's not why you're here. Yes. And the teachers like us to avoid this because parents, they're like, I will say to them, yes, you can when you bring your parents here. Mm-hmm. If parents want you to come with you, go for it. Yeah. But today,
and just to put it out here, none of these are nudes that are, they're not sexual in nature. No.
Right.
So just to throw that out.
But they all know about the statues. Not who does nothing about, but they all know about the nude statues.
Yeah.
That's what we're known for.
So did some of those, what I was wondering is some of the pieces that were stored in the courthouse basement, were some of them unfortunately just not repairable and they had to pitch them? Or
I think somewhere along the line, there were at least some that were damaged sufficiently. They were not. But in the 1980s, Jean Alice Small, who was publisher of the journal, and Don Delorier, who was our curator at that time at the museum, learned that the University of Delaware had a large collection of studio plasters by Barnard that they wanted to get rid of because it was not a collection area that they were interested in, apparently. I don't know. I've never uncovered how they happened to be there at the University of Delaware, just that they were.
Yeah.
But they negotiated with them and acquired the large collection, which is a lot of the larger pieces that are here. I think that the Peace Arch pieces and some of the other things. Overall, in this room, and a little bit as small pieces, tiny pieces in storage, we've got more than 24 plaster studies.
Wow.
And maybe even more than 36. It's a little hard to tell because I haven't checked lately.
Yeah.
But in order to have a proper place to display them, Mrs. Small and Don decided that they would, I think they did a fundraiser. There was probably a pretty good sized donation from the journal plus, or from the Small family plus a fundraising activity to build a proper display area for these materials. So, and in the 6th of December, 1991, the Barnard Gallery opened.
Okay.
The first picture I have of Barnard Gallery, in fact, this was on the day it opened.
Oh, wow.
And it was
more
sparsely inhabited than it is today.
Right.
We've brought more things out of storage
and
put them in place.
And I can't remember if we kind of explained this, and I know we did before we started recording, but kind of to explain the whole, the plaster study and then, these pieces that are here weren't actually the final product to kind of explain how that works.
However, they are, I think, something that people don't realize. They think, plaster statues, they can't be very important. These are the originals.
Right.
In many cases, these are what Barnard himself worked on. For things that were going to be translated into marble or for a bronze statue, assistants, trained assistants, very skilled people, did a lot of the work of completing that final piece that was going to be displayed or sold. But the concept and the original carving, the original sculpting, was done by Barnard in plaster. There are small studies called maquettes, which artists work with quite frequently. And there's an interesting one, right? And a study of Adam, which is in its full size, probably about life size, maybe a little larger than life size, lying on its back. We have the life size plaster study, but we also have the maquette for that. And it's very interesting when you look at the small study, which is about a foot long, as opposed to the 6 foot long finished one. There's a network of little black dots all over it, very evenly spaced out, covering it as a grid. Those are measuring points so that you could enlarge the original maquette to the larger finished size accurately. And I think that's really interesting. And most people, when they run across that, say, oh, I wouldn't know a thing
like that. Right. No, like, see, I didn't realize that this whole time, you know, that these were like the actual plaster that he crafted. And then a statue was actually created out of that, out of something else. Right. You know, I didn't realize that's how.
In some cases, of course, he was working directly even on the largest size rather than making a maquette first.
Yeah.
But for example, here's a study of Lincoln's head.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably one of the most famous pictures you ever see of Barnard. So.
And you can see Barnard up on his ladder, and there's a human figure. I don't know if there's his wife or just a visitor down below, but it gives you an idea of how absolutely gigantic it is. I'm not sure if that was, I don't think that was a study for the Lytle Park Lincoln. I think it may have just been one of his studies. He also, it's one of my favorites. This is called Rising Woman. And it's one of the most beautiful, elegant, graceful pieces of sculpture. I think it was, and I think that was done, was one of those that he worked on full size. Okay. Similarly, all the work he was doing for the Rainbow Arch. And again, looking at what was here, I think those were probably being done in proper, in the actual size. I don't know what decision he made to go one way or the other, whether to start small and go up or.
Yeah.
Or what it may have been that it was the small one might have been for a patron who was thinking of being a sponsor for
sure.
Or supporting it. Anyway, let's see. I'm trying to think. Did I mention that we do have one marble head of Lincoln here?
I think yes, okay, you did.
Yeah, that's you did mention that. On loan to us from the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Right. Speaking of Lincoln, though, we haven't even gotten to the hands part.
Yes. I was just going to say that was where we go next.
That is, we became kind of famous, I believe, across the country. Infamous, even late night TV jokes about
Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The hands. It's a sculpture, and we're going to show it.
Yeah, if you're watching the video version of this, we'll,
So we have it here, and it's this big by this big, and it's not real huge.
About the size of football.
And it's just a sculpture of hands together.
And I think maybe that was one of the partial studies for one of his Lincoln, whether it was the Lytle Park statue or one of the
other statues of Lincoln.
And one year, so you just do that, 2015. Christmas time, which is a crazy time here at the museum.
Yeah, gallery of trees.
And this museum is filled with artwork from the
gallery
students.
Of trees.
Oh, that too. That's right.
So it's a very busy gallery. Well, the hands disappeared. Somebody walked right out with it. Now, it was not encased then.
Like it is now.
Still sitting on it.
And
Camille Grosso, one of our staff members,
noticed,
happened to go through and thought, wait a minute, there's something missing here.
And the FBI was contacted because anything related to presidential whatevers. So the FBI was contacted. They took notes and information, and nothing, no particular anything that really we know of as to how or why or where it could have gone. And then in 2017, they came back, and I'll let Jack do that part of it.
Yeah, how did they come back? That's the another interesting
there
part.
There didn't seem to be any particular reason that they came back at that particular time, but all of a sudden we got a call from a member of the congregation at St. Rose Church. And he called and he said, you know, I was down in the vestibule of the church this morning and saw a bowling bag sitting there. I thought, well, that's kind of strange. I wonder what that is. And he said, and I opened it up and I think we found your hands, your Lincoln hands. And so we probably alerted the police to go over and check it out, of course. Mm-hmm. And then they returned us to us. And this time we decided to keep it in a locked case.
Smart.
Yes.
But everybody wanted to give us a hand in helping to find it.
Yeah.
And, so many
yes.
So many puns that you can put it.
Oh, and they did them all.
Oh,
yes, they did.
Gosh. Yeah.
So we have the stories on either side of the hands. If anybody wants to come also and read them, the stories about the abduction and then,
the
return. But we still don't know as to who or why or how. Or
I think the why is the kind of question that, you know, why this particular piece, other than maybe it was portable.
Yeah.
That's not exactly
it must
small.
Have been. I mean, you know, we can assume that maybe the person, I mean, I don't know. There's so many different ways this could go, right? But I guess one of them in my mind is that a person took them thinking there was value, and maybe they did some research and they couldn't really find like how they can make money from them, or like,
or
I don't know.
Kids doing a dare.
Kids doing a dare.
See if you can get away with it.
I don't know. I would think though, if it was for selling them, how would you sell them though without being outed, you know?
I don't know.
I think that would be almost totally unlikely.
And we'll probably never know, because if that person ever comes forward, they're going to be charged, right? So
it seems to me personally as an act of kind of remorse, that guilt that brought it back, because that's a really odd way of bringing it back.
It is.
In the church.
But you know, it's also kind of classic though, too. Yeah. It's like, oh, I'll just bring it to the bring it to a church and just leave it there. Like there's so many stories where people leave things at churches, you know, whether it's a baby or something of value.
Yeah, they don't want to go into the confessional with it.
No.
Exactly. But it's close enough.
It's close enough.
Well,
one thing, at least it was a little classier in a bowling bag than if it had been in a plastic Walmart sack.
Walmart.
Because they have food donations.
McDonald's bag or
every Sunday, people bring in food donations.
Right.
So that's part of where it was.
Okay.
It just happened to be in a different type of bag that looked a little suspicious.
Yeah.
But we are very thankful, whoever
brought them back, thank you.
Thank you. And we have it as our probably most prized possession. And what would George Gray Barnard think of that?
He's rolling over in his grave, you know. I know there's a lot of, we covered so much and there's even so much more to cover, but that just encourages people to come here to the museum.
Yes.
That's right.
If you have any questions about his childhood or about any of his works, we have a very full, very huge, humongous box of research. This is just a very little bit of it. And all his works across the country. And of course, this exhibit is very full and very full of information as well.
Yeah.
So anybody who would like to do further research on him as just individual or him as the sculptor, as artist, feel free to contact us. And
also,
we'll be happy to.
Sure.
You might want to note, too, that in addition, of course, to the main emphasis, which is the Barnard pieces here, this gallery is also used for other art shows. There's an example every December. There is a high school, Kankakee High School art show. I think that the Art League does shows occasionally, and there are a number of others. We find it's the right venue to expose the rest of art in this building rather than mm-hmm. you know, in just an empty room somewhere.
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. I agree. Mm-hmm. It's the perfect room for it. Mm-hmm. One last question I have too before mm-hmm. we wrap up is, obviously, besides these pieces being in a temperature controlled environment for mm-hmm. preservation, is there anything else that has to be done to these sculptures to keep them preserved? Because I mean, I don't know what the plaster, I don't know if that's like enough on its own to last a long time, or if something has to be, they have to be coated with something, or how do you know any?
Not that I know of. I think the okay. only treatment that we do with right now is to very carefully dust them off.
Okay. Because even dust, it can yeah. deteriorate them?
Well, no, just I think primarily just to keep them
looking,
from looking being good. Ugly.
Yeah. I was just curious if there was anything else that had to be done to keep, them preserved, or if the plaster was pretty sturdy on its own. Because obviously these are very old at this point.
Yeah, some of these pieces are, verging on 100 years old.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all of them are over 50 years old.
So yeah, exactly.
75.
I think keeping them in just a constant state of
steady temperature.
Steadiness is really
moisture would probably be the biggest advantage.
Yeah. Right, which we all know I'm sure the courthouse basement was not good for. No. So, mm-hmm. Or almost any basement for that matter.
Right. There was I'm trying to think of this. Something I heard many years ago, and I'm not sure whether it was true or not, but we did have, for a while, a couple of statues on loan to Westview High School Art Department, because one of our volunteer helper creators was the art teacher there, and she had borrowed them for her students and so forth. I believe we also had, I'm not sure if they still
KCC.
Are, at KCC, some of the
pieces. Okay.
There was one incident that was not an authorized piece. It was supposedly one of the a local building contractor who lived out in Limestone, who shall remain nameless, supposedly at one point, and I don't know how he carried it off, borrowed two of the larger statues, covered them up carefully in the back of his pickup truck, and took them out home to decorate a garden party.
Oh my gosh.
But that may have been apocryphal. I'm not sure.
It's
a story that I heard from Don Deluria, I think.
Now that you bring that story up, I feel like I might know who you're talking about too, but I won't say that. I won't say the name. I think it was Andrew.
Andrew, that's it.
Well, thank you both so much for doing this, as always, and especially right here in the Barnard exhibit. And hopefully this sheds some light to people that have walked through here before and like, why is this so important? Why do they have so much of this stuff?
Right.
We kind of answered all of that today.
Because people think, well, you're not an art museum.
Right.
You're a history museum. Well,
this is history too.
This is
history. We do, because we are the historical and arts building, and we were the Art League was part
of here.
So we are.
Yes.
So we do produce display artistic things as well as historical. And it just so happens he has foundation in our history as well as providing art.
Yes.
Yeah, in a way, you can say this room is the intersection of art and history.
It absolutely is. So this is a very perfect example of that. Mm-hmm. So as always, we encourage everyone to come check out the Kankakee County Museum. There's also the French Heritage Museum, which by the time this episode drops, the French Heritage Museum might be open for the season.
We need to mention something on the French Heritage Museum for
quite
some time.
Oh, the
cupola.
We've
been very concerned about the cupola on top of the museum needing repair.
Yes.
That's a 100-year-old plus building.
Yep.
In fact, 150-plus-year-old building.
One of the oldest in the area.
I don't think
the
cupola itself is that old, but anyway, has been creating some leakage problems and some rot and so forth. As we speak, the work is being done by a contractor to remedy that problem, courtesy mostly of donated funds and funds mm-hmm. raised by the museum's board to be able to do that so that we don't have deterioration of one of yeah. our most beloved pieces of local history and local architecture, since that's essentially mm-hmm. probably one of the oldest buildings downtown in yeah. Kankakee.
Oh, easily. Yeah, easily. We'll have to do actually an episode just on that building and the person who owned it, too.
We can so. Do it on location in the second floor.
We could. Ooh, that would be cool. I would like that. I would absolutely like yeah. that. Yeah. That'd be fun.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no room on the first floor.
No room.
Right.
That'd be wonderful, but yeah, there's no yeah. room.
If anybody would ever want to donate us an elevator, we'd love to put one
oh,
in there.
Oh, yeah, there we go. See, just bring those donations into the French Heritage right. Museum. They could use them. It's, as we've mentioned on previous episodes, it is very expensive to keep up the buildings that mm-hmm. the museum operates and functions out of. So,
and it holds our entire French Canadian historical heritage. Facts and, yeah. and artifacts and
our genealogy mission. Files mm-hmm. out as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well,
that one draws people from all over the country and all over the world.
Yes, it does. Right. Yeah. I'm always hearing
well, so do
about
we.
That.
Yeah,
right.
So do we. Yeah.
Right. But I feel like especially the French Heritage Museum, mm-hmm. you get people from all over the world at that museum mm-hmm. all the time. So, yeah, just go to KankakeeCountyMuseum.com. If you want to get more details, you can also follow on Facebook and Instagram at Kankakee County Museum as well.
All right.
Thank you, Jack and Jory.
Well, thank you. You know, it is our pleasure.
It's our pleasure to be
always
here.
To do
it's
this.
It's always great to have you here.
Thank you.
That concludes this episode of Kankakee Podcast. I'm Jake Lamore. Thank you so much for listening. Please hit that subscribe button if you haven't already. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Kankakee Podcast. Shout out to Carrie O'Connell for supporting the show each month through Patreon. If you want your name announced on a future episode, sign up at patreon.com/Kankakee Podcast. Special thanks to our sponsors, Chicago Dough Company, Noble Dairy Queen Stores, Frank's Appliance Center and Sleep Source, Pigosh Engineering, King Music, Little Me's Studio, Taco John's, D. Westfall Jewelers, and Edward Jones Financial Advisor, Adam Elroy. Kankakee Podcast is produced by the fine team at Pathfinder, a full-service marketing agency in downtown Kankakee. Learn more at yourpathfinder.io. Our theme song is by Lupe Carroll.